Mr. Clerk, you can call the next case.
Second case, A23-1648, State of Minnesota Respondent versus William Connell Walton.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. In a moment, you will commence your argument. Counsel, before you begin your argument, please state your name as we are recording this matter, and that recording will be issued after the argument. In addition, each of you will have 15 minutes, with the appellant getting an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. I know you both have been here quite a bit, and you know that. With that, counsel, you can begin when you are ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, William Walton. Mr. Walton was convicted of violating Minnesota's domestic abuse no contact order statute based on his violation of a Rhode Island no contact order. He received a stayed sentence of 21 months based on a criminal history score of 3, with all 3 points coming from North Carolina convictions. Today, we are challenging both the conviction and the sentence. First, the plain language of Section 629.75, the Danko statute, shows that it only applies to Minnesota no-contact orders. It defines Dankos as ordered issued by courts in specific types of Minnesota proceedings, and unlike other similar statutes, it does not say that it punishes violations of similar out-of-state orders. Mr. Walton was convicted based on a Rhode Island order. Because that out-of-state order does not fall within the purview of Section 629.75, his conviction must be reversed. And even if that statute can cover out-of-state orders, the state here failed to prove that the order in this case was issued in one of the types of proceedings covered by Subdivision 1. Alternatively, all of the convictions used for Mr. Walton's criminal history score were from out-of-state offenses. And for all of those offenses, Mr. Walton received sentences with a minimum duration of less than 1 year, but a maximum duration of more than 1 year. But the state didn't present any evidence to show how long any of the sentences Mr. Walton served actually were, and thus it failed to prove that he received sentences that would be considered in felonies in Minnesota. Because it failed to meet that burden of proving his out-of-state convictions could be counted as felonies, we alternatively ask this court to reverse his sentence and remand for resentencing with a criminal history score of 0. Just sort of turning back to my first argument about the plain language of the statute. Section 629.75, Domestic Abuse No Contact Order, it's defined as an order issued by a court against a defendant in a criminal proceeding or juvenile offender delinquency proceeding for, and then it lists domestic abuse in Section 518B.01 Subdivision 2, harassment or stalking under Section 609.749 against a family or household member, violation of an order for protection under 518B.01 Subdivision 14, or violation of a prior domestic abuse no contact order issued under that section, or Minnesota Statutes 2008 Section 518B.01 Subdivision 22, which is where the DACO statute formerly was housed. The statute then moves on to punishment and says that anyone who knows of the existence of a domestic abuse no contact order and violates it is guilty of a crime. This statute is limited to Minnesota orders because if we read that language, it begins with courts in Minnesota talking about proceedings for certain violations of certain Minnesota statutes. This is a statute that covers Minnesota orders. It doesn't have any language like the OFP statute that says an order issued by a court or a similar state law type of order.
However, counsel, in looking at Subdivision 1, it seems to me it says a domestic abuse no contact order is 1, an order, 2, issued by a court, and 3, against a defendant, and 4, in a criminal proceeding or juvenile offender in a delinquency proceeding. It says used by a court. It seems to me when it qualifies a court, doesn't that seem to just say that a court, whether it's a court here in Minnesota, a court in Rhode Island, that is sufficient? And really the fourth part, that being whether or not the no contact order falls within this statute, would be whether or not it's one of those four kind of qualifiers. It's a domestic abuse, no contact order is defined by 518B01, a harassment restraining order, so on and so forth.
Correct, Your Honor. And I agree with the first part there. It's not limited in its language. It's not, you know, as the state points out, it doesn't say a court of the state. But it's still limited by those provisions of 1, 2, 3, 4. That's where we have to keep going. If we just stop with a court in this state against the defendant, criminal proceedings, sure, that could be anything.
So then isn't this then really a sufficiency of the evidence issue, that being that not that a court outside of Minnesota, an order from a court outside of Minnesota can be utilized as a domestic abuse no contact order, rather whether or not this particular no contact order, this Rhode Island one, was sufficient to meet the elements of this offense?
I sort of raised it both ways. And that second part is my alternative argument, and I do want to turn to that for just a moment. But to go back to the first part, it is still limited because it is still a court in it, you know, against defendant criminal proceeding, but for domestic abuse defined in Minnesota statute, for stalking in Minnesota statutes.
When we look at little paren one,
mm-hmm.
You know, each of these is written differently.
Yep.
Paren one, domestic abuse as defined in 518B01 sub 2. And then you look at that and it says, you know, family member, physical harm, bodily injury, et cetera. Why couldn't that? I understand how that's going to play into your second argument, but on your first argument, just if you have a definition that is there and if they were proved that it satisfied that definition, I'm not really seeing why it couldn't be a Minnesota court. That argument for one.
Why it
paragraph
couldn't be
one.
A Minnesota court.
Why, excuse me,
yeah,
why it has to be a Minnesota
yeah,
court.
Why I don't
why
win,
it couldn't be an out-of-state. Why
yeah.
You make sense. Yeah, exactly. Why it couldn't be an out-of-state court.
Because it's still pointing
it's
you to...
Because it's as defined. It's not... That's a pretty general thing. And you look at the definition. Oh, yeah, it meets that definition.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could meet that definition. But even in there, you know, they still have definitions. They're still citing you in the definition of domestic abuse to other Minnesota statutes. Even before we get to the ones that talk about...
I don't see that in sub 2...
Three, terroristic threats within the meaning of 609.713 criminal
sexual... Oh, you're looking at the other ones and then importing those into...
Yeah, because it's still talking about Minnesota law. Even assault, while it's not citing the statute, assault has a definition under Minnesota law in 609.02 on what that actually means. It actually sort of covers both one and two. And so we're still talking about Minnesota law, even if we sort of circle back to there. It's still looping you into Minnesota definitions. And to just sort of get maybe to the second part on the problem we have here on the other part of the argument, I know I filed a citation of supplemental authority yesterday citing the Rhode Island definition of domestic violence, 1224-29-2. It sort of shows the problem here because Minnesota has a definition of domestic abuse. So even if we want to say it's other courts and we have that definition and we can look at it and we can say, okay, bodily harm, you know, injury, that makes sense. It doesn't necessarily mean that the order in this case falls within that, because the reason I wanted to cite the court to that Rhode Island law is their definition of domestic violence is far broader. You know, we're talking about in 518B02, physical harm, bodily injury, assault, or the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, assault. You compare that to Rhode Island, the sort of things that fall in there, vandalism, disorderly conduct, trespass, that's a far broader definition. So to sort of my alternative argument, as we were mentioning earlier, then the state would need to prove that this isn't just an order issued in a general domestic violence case, which seems to be their position. It says domestic on top, it must be that. But in Rhode Island, again, trespass is not domestic abuse under Minnesota law. So if the order here was issued in one of those sorts of cases, then it wouldn't actually be a Danko under the definition in Minnesota law. So the state didn't meet its burden of proving that this order that Mr. Walton had against him was domestic abuse as defined by 518B subdivision 2, which is sort of another problem here. I think that's part of the reason why we maybe want to limit this to Minnesota orders is because that's going to be tough. We sort of get into a whole mess, a trial over, well, what's covered, what's not covered.
Don't we get into that mess at sentencing when we're looking at criminal history points in terms of whether an out-of-state conviction should be included as a criminal history point?
If he got points for this, which he didn't, yes, we would then sort of get into that mess as well.
Big picture. You're like, well, it's a mess. Let's just apply it only here. That way we don't need to look at other states and their laws and do a comparison. But we already do that at sentencing. And sort of the argument you were just making about what the state would need to do, assuming the conviction can be based on an out-of-state order for protection, is exactly what the state has to do at sentencing, which is, okay, show us or prove what happened to justify this order so we can compare it to what would be necessary and whether or not it would justify Danco here.
Sure.
So that's something we already do, right?
It's something we do, but to a far lesser degree, because at trial it would have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And at sentencing, it's just preponderance. That's what they need to prove the felony. So they do have that lower burden. It would be easier in getting sort of documents in. They don't have to be certified conviction. There is sort of the lower evidentiary standard at that point. So they do it, but even if that's what we want to say, okay, you still have to do it at trial. It didn't happen here. That's right.
So no evidence was presented regarding the basis for the Rhode Island order?
No. All we know is that there is an order, and I'm not contesting that. I won't contest that it says no contact order domestic on top, but sort of as the statute from Rhode Island that the state cited and that I've cited show, we don't know what sort of offense it came. And it could be anything. If they had an identical statute, I would probably not be making this argument today. But because it's so much broader, they needed to prove that it was that type of order. I think maybe I will just briefly touch on sentencing since we sort of started going there anyway. The problem here and what separates this case from cases like Finley is that in order for it to be counted as a felony, you need to sort of match the elements and the offender has to receive a sentence that in Minnesota would be the equivalent of a felony. We're not debating that they have, you know, matched sort of robbery to robbery, larceny to theft of a motor vehicle. The problem is that for all those points, Mr. Walton received sentences that on the low end could have been less than a year, could have been not a felony in Minnesota. And on the high end, maybe they were. But what separates this case from Finley, which is the case that the state cited, or for Walton, which is a published case of this court, is that there the sentences were hypothetical. They didn't know how long he was going to serve. He was on probation. Maybe he would have served more than a year, maybe he wouldn't have, but the state didn't have to prove that at sentencing. Mr. Walton served these sentences. Mr. Walton was sentenced to the custody of the commissioner there, as marked that, you know, what was presented at sentencing. There are commitment sheets, the little boxes checked for sending him to the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections. It even says in the PSI that these were commits. So he served a sentence, but the state failed to prove how long that sentence was, and that matters, because if all he served was 9 months, then that sentence is not a felony in Minnesota. It couldn't be counted as a felony. So the difference here between Finley and this case is the sentences weren't hypothetical. The sentences were real, but the state failed to prove how long those sentences actually were.
But does it matter, even if he served less than a year, if he could have been sentenced to more than a year?
Yes, because his sentence, according to the guidelines, it has to be a felony sentence. So that he could, maybe let me give you a Minnesota example, and I'm going to tweak it just a little bit. If two people have a stay of imposition and a felony, and then both of them commit a new offense, and before that happens, for person A, the judge says, I'm not revoking that stay. You still have a stay of imposition. And for person B, they say, you knucklehead, I'm done with you. I'm going to revoke this, but you have credit for 300 days. I'm going to sentence you to 300 days, and we're going to close this file. When it comes to sentencing then on this new offense, person A, who still has that stay of imposition, gets the felony point. Person B, under the guidelines, doesn't get a felony point, because they've served less than a felony sentence, so that would not be counted as a felony.
What's your authority for that conclusion?
That's in the guidelines. I think it's 2B1H.
The guidelines say if you are sentenced, if you receive a stay of imposition and are ultimately sentenced to serve less than a year, it doesn't count as a felony.
It doesn't say that, but it says that then you look at the sentence that they actually serve. And if you have a felony sentence, if it was a felony conviction.
Can I have that slide again, please?
I believe it is. I will confirm it. For rebuttal, I believe it's 2B1H. It's in just the basic part about prior felonies while we're still in Minnesota. That if
what,
a prior.
What do you do with the definition of a felony being a crime for which a sentence of imprisonment for more than 1 year may be imposed? I mean, under that definition, an offense would still be a felony if the law allowed imposition of more than 1 year, even though less than 1 year was given.
But what we care about is what they actually served, if the sentence has been served. If that sentence has been executed, what we care about is that time. And that's what also the guidelines say in out of state. It has to be both defined as a felony in Minnesota, and he received a sentence in Minnesota that would be a felony. So it's not that he could have, because this is a historical sentence.
But counsel, isn't it received. I think it seems to me that, well, is received different than serve? It seems to me that the guidelines is, in using its language, it talks about sentences that are imposed and sentences that are received. It doesn't say anything about sentences that are actually served, and it seems to me that serving a sentence is very different than receiving a sentence. And I guess I would like you to tell me, why am I wrong on that?
You know, I think that the point isn't necessarily that you're wrong. The point is that we care about how long someone actually served. And we want to treat people the same. And that's the point of the guidelines. We want out of state to be treated the same as Minnesota. We want that, you know, congruence in sentences. So if you were in Minnesota and you received a sentence that was less than that, you served a sentence that was less than a felony, if it was less than a year and a day, you wouldn't get a criminal history point.
But
we should treat people.
But wouldn't the Guidelines Commission in drafting that rule say served? It seems to me that the fact that they're saying it's received, it's in essence the sentence that is imposed versus the sentence that you actually, you know, serve. So that's my hang up is the word usage of receive and impose versus served.
Yeah, I see my time's expired. Can I briefly just address that, though?
Absolutely.
I think another thing we need to think about is that sentences work differently in other states. And North Carolina doesn't even have gross misdemeanors, for example. They only have a misdemeanor. They have a felony. So what we care about is what actually happened here. So if he only served, I understand he received it, and I won't debate. You know, that's what it says, and that you could say he received a sentence with a minimum and a maximum. But if he served less than a year, if he was in Minnesota, that wouldn't be a felony. So don't we want to treat those out-of-state people? Because, again, it's not a hypothetical sentence. He served it. This sentence is done.
I'm looking, may I?
You may.
I'm looking at 2B1H that you're relying on. It doesn't say anything about serving. It says when a prior felony conviction resulted in a non-felony sentence. And a sentence is the amount of time that was imposed or pronounced. It's not what was actually served. So if a judge says, well, you're here on a felony, I'm sentencing you to 90 days, well, then that's a misdemeanor. But if a judge says your sentence is indeterminate, it may range from 90 days to 380 days, well, then that could have been a felony sentence. And that is the sentence. It's based on what was, you know, imposed or received, not what was served. The word served doesn't appear in 2B1H.
No, but I think that if I could just briefly respond, and I'll be short, just that if, you know, I understand that words matter and I'm also here debating words, but I think that if Mr. Walton served only 9 months, we would also say he received a 9-month sentence. If the state had presented evidence showing that he served 13 months, then we'd say he received a 13-month sentence. So again, because it's not a possibility, because it was something real that the state didn't present evidence to show.
What if the judge sentenced to 14 months and then vacated the last two? The sentence hasn't changed. The judge still sentenced to 14 months. I hear what you're saying about what we should look at, what a person actually served, but I'm not aware of anything in the guidelines that supports that approach explicitly or in the case law that supports that approach. The case law and guidelines seem to look at what was the sentence imposed, and that's what determines. And I know there was one case where there was a stay of adjudication and then less than a felony amount was ordered, and I think that was a decision of our case, but I also recall that in that case, the district court specifically said, I'm resentencing you. So, you know, I originally said stay of imp, that was a felony sentence. I'm resentencing you to 340 days. And we said, well, now that was a gross misdemeanor because the sentence was explicitly changed. But when you have a case where the judge says, I'm sentencing you to something that would constitute a felony, and then the person, for whatever reason, serves less than the felony amount of time. I mean, what about good time? I mean, how would your argument impact good time? A person gets ordered to do a year, but they only serve 9 months. Does that mean it's no longer a felony sentence because they only served 9 months?
Well, it's still on the state to prove it because the state is still bears the burden here of proving the criminal history score. So the state would need to prove all this stuff about good time. I don't know how supervision works in North Carolina. And the reason, in part, I don't know is because the state didn't present anything about
it. Your argument in general that we should be looking at the amount of time served.
Sure.
How does that impact the application of good time, which could bring a low-level felony sentence of, I guess it's 365 now, below that number in terms of time served, does that mean that's no longer a felony sentence?
Well, it's difficult because Minnesota has determinate sentencing. Because we know, I mean, we don't have good time anymore. You serve two-thirds and you're out one-third. That's how it works now.
Okay, but then under your argument, the person served 9 months.
Sure.
So it's not a felony.
But it, because we have determinate sentencing, it is a felony. But the state had to prove what it was like in North Carolina, because I don't think it translates so easily from Minnesota on to North Carolina.
Okay, but I'm not understanding how you reconcile your position that whether or not something should be counted as a felony in criminal history score depends on the amount of time served.
Because I don't know if North Carolina has good time. I don't know if Mr. Walton serves 9 months and then he's done, okay, or if he serves more.
So your argument is limited to outstate sentences.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Counsel.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petris, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. I'd first like to address a few of the arguments appellant has made about the Dangle issued by a Rhode Island court, and then I plan to make a couple points about Judge Jansen's determination of appellant's criminal history score. Building on a question that Judge Smith asked a little bit ago, Minnesota Statute 629.75, the Danko statute, Subdivision 1A, states, quote, a Danko is an order issued by a court against a defendant in a criminal proceeding for, and then lists four different things, clauses 1, 2, 3, and 4. And clause 1 says a criminal proceeding for domestic abuse as defined in Minnesota Statute Section 518B.01, Subdivision 2. And then when we turn to that particular statutory provision, Section 518B.01, Subdivision 2, it provides three alternative definitions of domestic abuse. And the third definition of domestic abuse, so that's, again, under that same section, Subdivision 2A3, that ties the definition to specific Minnesota statutes. 609.713, it's the family of criminal sexual assault statutes, criminal sexual conduct statutes, 609.3458 and 609.78. But the first two definitions of domestic abuse, as defined by Section 518B.01, Subdivision 2, state as follows. Physical harm, bodily injury, or assault committed against a family or household member, or the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, again committed against a family or household member. Those two definitions of domestic abuse are not tied to any specific Minnesota statutory provisions. And we know the legislature knows how to tie them to a specific Minnesota statute because they do that in the third alternative definition there. So not only does a court exist in every state, but a proceeding for physical harm, a proceeding for bodily injury, or a proceeding for assault also exists in every state. If you look at the plain language of Minnesota statutes 629.75, Subdivision 1A, especially when it is read in conjunction with what it explicitly references, 518B.01, Subdivision 2, it does not limit the violation of a Danko offense to only Dankos that are issued in Minnesota.
Counsel, how do we know that the Danko or the order from Rhode Island was based on the conduct you just described from the statute? Right. Domestic assault, harm, fear of harm.
There are a variety of reasons that satisfy that sufficiency challenge, essentially, to what type of order that was. It's titled, obviously, a no-contact order - domestic, and its caption clearly indicates it was issued in a criminal proceeding.
The definition of domestic in Rhode Island includes trespass and vandalism, how do we know that, despite its title of domestic, it wasn't a trespass case?
There's multiple reasons. I understand this court may not be inclined to rely on the PSI for that sufficiency, but page 3 of the PSI clearly states that it's for simple assault and first-degree battery.
Was the author of the CSI called to the stand to provide testimony under oath?
She was not. I understand.
Case law that says we don't then look at the PSI?
Let's go back to, not typically for sufficiency purposes, but in several of the opinions you've written, Your Honor, on criminal history score purposes, as cited in Mr. Donovan's brief. Let's go back to Exhibit 3. Exhibit 3 is the Danko itself, the single-page order. It clearly indicates there is an alleged victim, and that alleged victim is an adult, and in fact, the evidence in this case clearly establishes that that alleged victim, M.M., is the same person who appellant was found and got into the altercation with and the Mall of America.
That's all well and good, and that's all true, but ultimately the statute then has those four buckets: domestic assault, harassment, stalking, violation of an order for protection under the Minnesota statute for order for protection 518B01, and then violation of a prior domestic abuse order. Subdivision 1's physical harm, bodily injury, assault, infliction of fear of bodily injury, physical assault, and also terroristic threats, criminal sexual conduct, sexual extortion, and interfering with a 911 call. Rhode Island defines domestic assault very differently to have a more expansive list of offenses. Because they have a more expansive list of offenses, and the jury would not have been privy to the PSI, it seems to me that the statute is very clear that it has to be a domestic abuse no contact order, which falls into that small box of cases. And I'm trying to figure out where on Exhibit 3 tells me that this is a domestic abuse no contact order, which is about physical harm, interference with 911 call, or any of the four exceptions in 629.75 subdivision 1. Again, it does show that it's a criminal action. I don't think a defense is disputing that. It does say that Ms. M.M. is the victim. I think it's clear on the face of it. It does note that it's a criminal case. But from my reading, I see nothing on Exhibit 3 that tells me that it's a domestic abuse order, which is defined under 518B01 subdivision 2, which is what the statute says, that it's a harassment or stalking restraining order under 609.749, that it's a violation of an order for protection under 518.01 subdivision 14, or that it is a violation of a prior domestic abuse no contact order under 518.01 subdivision 22. So where within this order is it one of those four things?
I apologize.
Oh, no problem. Go ahead.
I don't have Rhode Island General Laws 12-29-2 in front of me. That's what was cited yesterday in Mr. Donovan's supplemental authority letter. It defines domestic violence as compared to domestic abuse. And it has, I'm just estimating here, maybe 12 to 14 different statutorily defined offenses in Rhode Island. And they include, like Mr. Donovan mentioned before, trespassing, disorderly conduct, damaging a telephone, vandalism, child snatching. In none of those offenses is there an adult victim. Obviously, in the criminal proceeding in this case, in terms of in Rhode Island, the court file number, there was an adult victim because that adult victim is specifically identified on the plain text of Exhibit 3. That's what distinguishes those other forms of domestic violence that those possible definitions of domestic violence in Rhode Island from where they are not included in the Minnesota definition of domestic abuse.
But counsel, couldn't Ms. Minter have been a victim of, for example, disorderly conduct in Rhode Island? And under Rhode Island statute, a domestic abuse no contact order could have been issued because she's the victim of, for example, disorderly conduct. Under that scenario, would you say that this order would then suffice to be a domestic abuse no contact order in Minnesota?
I think you need to infer from the record that's here. Obviously, that was not challenged at all during the court trial in this case. And when Judge Jansen was finding him guilty, she did not have the benefit from any argument or challenge as to what that proceeding was in Rhode Island. It was just kind of accepted.
Isn't that the problem in that in order for you to be convicted in Minnesota, you need to have a domestic abuse no contact order? We specifically defined a domestic abuse no contact order within Minnesota statute, and there was nothing in the record which tells us that this particular order out of Rhode Island fell within a Minnesota definition. Isn't that the problem? And because we don't have that information, why wouldn't this court, or tell me why this court would not say that the evidence wasn't sufficient to find one of the key elements, that being that there was a domestic abuse no contact order issued by a court?
I don't think it's a problem because Judge Jansen inferred from the information that was presented to her, and that includes Exhibit 3 and all the testimony from the witnesses that testified in that court trial. There is no Minnesota statute that prohibits, as in its plain text, bodily injury.
In terms of the judge or the finder of fact inferring, I mean, essentially what you're saying, it was circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
And so if we were going to apply the circumstantial evidence test here, we would say, well, is one reasonable inference from the face of the Rhode Island order that it involves some sort of domestic situation? Sure. Well, then your opposition would say, well, another reasonable inference is that it did not, because there are these other things like trespass and disorderly conduct and vandalism, and I'm not sure that those offenses don't have a victim, because if you own the property that's been vandalized, why aren't you a victim? But before we go off on that track, I don't know that that saves the day in terms of a sufficiency challenge, because if it's an inference, it's circumstantial, we have to look at, are there other reasonable inferences, and why isn't there a reasonable inference that it was not a domestic situation given the breadth of conduct that's covered under the Rhode Island statute?
I think it is not reasonable to believe it. First off, Rhode Island General Law 12-29-4, which is what I cited in my brief initially, talks about the issuance of an order not being required. It's in the discretion of the court or the judge in Rhode Island. And I think it would not be reasonable for, you know, a damaging a telephone or a vandalism for a no contact or a domestic to be issued in those cases. I think you have to recognize the relationship between the parties, which was established at trial.
And that, you take that up with the legislature in Rhode Island. You may not think it would be reasonable, but they've authorized district courts to issue a no contact order based on vandalism or trespass.
Well, let's hit it from a different direction, okay? So let's look at the second alternative definition of domestic abuse in 518B.01 subdivision 2. That's the intentional infliction of fear, of physical harm, of bodily injury, or of assault. So we're not talking about a physical harm, we're just talking about the fear at that point. And if you have a domestic relationship with someone and they vandalize your house, or if you have a domestic relationship with somebody and they come in and they break your telephone, if they have domestic relations with someone and they commit disorderly conduct towards you, I believe that would qualify then under the second alternative definition of domestic abuse.
Why are we in the position to have to guess about all this? If, you know, the case law is pretty clear when it comes to out-of-state convictions and whether or not they are the equivalent of a felony sentence here and a felony sentence was imposed, the state has the burden of establishing both things at sentencing. I'm pretty sure there's case law that says if you compare the two definitions of the offense, and it's possible that under the definition of the out-state offense, this might not have been a felony because it includes far greater conduct than we have, then we don't know it was a felony, and if the issue wasn't raised, the state gets an opportunity for a do-over to prove up the conduct underlying the conviction to show that it was a felony, should be counted as a felony here. But here we are at trial, and now the state is saying, well, we want to be able to use out-state no-contact orders to prove a violation of a DANCO here. Well, that's fine and good. If you are in the situation we are, where you have two statutes, the outstate statute is broader, and we would not be willing to take it on faith in the sentencing context, whether the burden of proof is lower, that in fact the outstate conviction arose from circumstances that meet our definition of felony, why would we be willing to take it on faith or to guess or make assumptions that the outstate DANCO is based on the conditions we require when it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
I want to answer the first part of your question before I get to the second part. I believe you began the question, Judge Larkin, by saying, why are we having to guess? And we're having to guess because it wasn't challenged at trial.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, because what you're essentially saying is...
Just giving a practical explanation. I understand the burden of proof.
No, but what you're essentially saying is they didn't challenge the fact that the state was failing to prove up its case at trial. You're essentially saying that there's like a plain error review. The defense doesn't have to notify the state at trial, you're screwing up. You need to present evidence of X, Y, and Z in order to convict me. The defense has no obligation to do that. So the argument that, well, we're in a tough position because the defense didn't object and point out that our evidence was insufficient, the defense doesn't have to do that. That's on you to know what not you, but the prosecutor. So let's not go there.
I understand. I was sorry for being a bit too long-winded and trying to get the practical explanation out there. I understand. The state had this information, and it was not presented at trial. The PSI writer, the probationary officer who prepared that, had that information available. They did not testify. That was not in the record in which Judge Jansen relied on to find the defendant guilty. So if that is what it takes, then there is not going to be the ability to use that piece from the PSI. That information was obviously known, but it was not established.
Why should you be allowed to use it when we're reviewing for proof beyond a reasonable doubt when we don't let you use it when we're reviewing under preponderance standard?
Well, I don't have that much time left, but in terms of the two decisions that I believe it's Paulson and Keltner, both of which you authored, Judge Larkin, in which you specifically write you can't rely on the PSI, both of those cases, I think they were distinguishing it from Maley, or actually analogizing it to Maley, was that Judge Harris, I see my time is about to expire. Can I finish answering my question?
Yeah, and then I will give you just a brief moment, too. I know you wanted to address the third issue, and we've been questioning you quite a bit. I'll give you a brief moment to briefly address that issue if you need to.
Appreciate that, Judge Harris. It's totally lost my train of thought. I apologize. Judge Larkin, in those two non-presidential decisions from 2022 and 2023, in those particular cases, there was no additional documentation. It was relying solely on the bald PSI, whereas in this case, we had the trial exhibit 5, we had sentencing exhibits 1 through 14, and that's what established those out-of-state convictions there. I understand that there was no out-of-state conviction for the proceeding where the Danko came from, which was not North Carolina but was Rhode Island, and that's because, as I understand it, it was a pretrial Danko, which is indicated again on the face of Exhibit 3 when it says this will remain in effect until FOC, further order of the court.
Is this an appropriate case for a published opinion saying, under the plain language of 627.95, a prosecution for violation of domestic abuse no contact order is not limited to a prosecution based on violation of Minnesota, it may be an outstate order. However, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the order on which it relies would, in fact, justify a Danko under our statute.
Yes.
So then you would simply need to be prepared at trial to prove the basis for the outstate order beyond a reasonable doubt.
And my state's position, just to be clear, is that that happened in this case. I can understand this panel's questions and how you're likely to rule in this case. But again, the state stands by the position it took, both in arguing for Mr. Walton's guilt at trial, as well as a position on appeal. To briefly address the third issue, Judge Harris, in terms of that third issue, I guess second issue, if you can split up the first issue into two. I think with Finley, which again is another opinion about criminal history scores authored by Judge Larkin, and then Watson, which I know Judge Smith was on that panel, I believe that the analysis in those cases about, and just kind of echoing what I heard this panel asking Mr. Donovan about before, about when you have a judge imposing a sentence, if it's a determinate range or an indeterminate range, that is what's used to define whether or not a felony sentence exists. And the state obtained all the certified copies of everything related to those convictions that existed. The length of time, use one example, whether it was 8 months or whether it was 19 months for one of those North Carolina convictions that was actually spent in custody, that was determined not by a judge, that was determined by the State Department of Corrections. And I'm not aware of any legal authority that says that what a state, prison official ultimately decides in terms of how much custody time is serving, that controls whether or not a sentence is defined as a felony or a misdemeanor. I am past time. I appreciate the opportunity to address that issue briefly. I'm more than happy to answer any other questions that remain.
Thank you, counsel.
I respectfully ask this court to affirm.
Mr. Donovan.
Thank you. I actually don't have anything on rebuttal, but I just wanted to make sure the panel didn't have any other questions.
I do have one.
Go. Going back to the question I asked, defendant Minnesota gets sentenced to a year, which is now a felony, serves 8 months with good time. We still count that as a felony for sentencing purposes. But if a person from another state is sentenced to a year, serves 8 months, you're saying, well, that person's sentence should not be counted as a felony because he only served 8 months. As I understood your explanation is we should treat out-state sentences different. But isn't the whole point of the guidelines to treat everyone similarly? And aren't they written in a way to ensure that we treat out-state people similarly? And if so, why would we have a rule that says if you're sentenced to a year here but only serve 8 months, it counts as a felony in your criminal history score, but if you're sentenced to a year in Rhode Island and only serve 8 months, it counts as a gross misdemeanor. Why would we have that difference?
The difference is, again, because it's so difficult to take our nice and clean determinate sentencing system and our guidelines and then use indeterminate sentencing and trying to graft that on. Because in Minnesota, for example, with your example,
why that makes a difference. If all you're saying is, well, if it's an out-state conviction, we're just going to look at the time served.
Because in Minnesota, let's use your year-and-a-day sentence. You serve 9 months, you're out for three. In Minnesota, let's say you get out on day one, you screw up, you get drunk, you go crazy, the Commissioner of Corrections can send you back for the 3 months and you can serve the whole year. Okay. I don't know what they do in North Carolina. It's possible Mr. Walton got out after 9 months and the commissioner there said, have fun, you're not on supervised release. But we have that release period, so you still can potentially serve. We know when you have a felony sentence and it's executed, we know you could potentially serve more than a year because any violation can cause a revocation of your release. I don't know if that's what they do in North Carolina.
Understood.
So I guess also one other thing, I would agree this is a good case for a published opinion, Your Honor. So if the panel has no further questions, we would ask you to reverse the conviction and alternatively reverse the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. This case is submitted. The court will issue an order in the statutory time. Thank you both, counsel, for your time here today.